This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
This advertisement feature is paid and presented by Go Türkiye. This is what most people come to Antalya for: beach, sun, and not much else. And that's fine. But head inland just a little and you can experience a different kind of Antalya. At Köprülü Canyon National Park, one of Türkiye's most accessible places for adventure sports and personal favorite spot of local guide Berfin Özçelik.
You can spend your whole day here. First, you should go to the canyon to do rafting. But there is so much more than that.
Yes, it's not just adrenaline that's to be found in these hills. High above the river, the pillars of Adam Rock surround the ruins of Selge, an ancient city that's been here far longer than the rafting routes.
Selge is like a gem waiting to be discovered.
So it's not exactly what you expected from a day in Antalya, but that's exactly the point. Plan your next detour at goturkiye.com today.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Ronovich. The Briefing Room, 28 minutes in which you and I get the top experts to explain a big issue of the day. This week, soon, nearly 6 million benefit claimants will lose the £20 weekly pandemic uplift. What impact will that have on them? And are there better ways we could help those in need? In today's Financial Times, it was reported that an internal government analysis described an upcoming change as potentially catastrophic. That change is the ending of the £20 weekly uplift received by all universal credit claimants during the pandemic. Giving things to people is always the easy bit of government. Taking them away is always the hardest, especially when there are 6 million losers. So what will the impact of the withdrawal be? And might there be better ways of helping the less well off? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, what is universal credit? Why was it introduced and who gets it? And how well is it working? Fran Bennett is an expert on welfare at the Department of Social Policy and Intervention at Oxford University. Fran Bennett, what exactly is universal credit?
So what it is that it brought together various means-tested benefits and tax credits, which were either to help with your income or to help with additional costs. The one means-tested benefit, or the one main means-tested benefit that's left out of this, is help with council tax, local taxation. And it's assessed each month. So it's what your circumstances are on a particular day, which is kind of your assessment day in the month.
Let's be clear. Who gets it?
Well, because it's means tested, it's for people on a low income and also for people without much in savings. But the crucial thing about universal credit is that it's paid to people in and out of work. And that's the difference it's made with previous benefits and tax credit systems.
OK. Now, what did it replace? Because my recollection of the benefit system was that it was incredibly complex.
It replaces income support. It replaced job seekers allowance, which is for people who are looking for work. And it replaced employment and support allowance, which is for people whose disability or health condition means that it's difficult for them to work or they can't work at all. Plus housing benefit, which is to help meet your housing costs if you're on a low income. And the tax credits it replaced are working tax credit and child tax credit, which actually was for people in and out of work, like housing benefit. Child tax credit was obviously for people with children, but universal credit brings most of them together, apart from help with council tax.
And so what was it hoped that universal credit would achieve that the previous benefit system didn't manage?
Well, it was partly simplification, and it has to be said that was widely supported. This was meant to be one application for all those different benefits, and that would largely be online. And then the other thing was that universal credit is said to be about work. So it's about work. It's very much focused on people getting into work. It's meant to be like work. So it's meant to be paid in a similar way to wages, according to the government. And it's also meant to help people progress in work. And the idea of that is to become independent of means-tested state support. So there was quite a lot about welfare dependency and trying to stop so-called welfare dependency.
Now, listeners will remember that a couple of years ago, there were, maybe longer, there were significant problems with the rollout of universal credit. Can you just remind us about what caused those, what they were, and tell us to what extent that's been solved?
Yes, you could describe universal credit as having had a difficult birth, really. I think that was partly because of the technology systems being underestimated, or the complexity of those systems being underestimated. But there were certainly, or there have been, and there are, huge delays in introducing universal credit. And there have been some changes to the system because of the critical reports that were issued. So National Audit Office issued critical reports, so did the Work and Pensions Select Committee, and some things have been changed. For example, to begin with, the government had introduced 7 waiting days to universal credit and they abolished those. There is still what is often called the 5-week wait. This is actually integral to universal credit in a way because it's a monthly assessed benefit. So you have to wait to the end of the month to see what income you got during that month and what your circumstances are. And there have been various ways in which that has been ameliorated. The government has advances, which means that you can have an advance of your universal credit award that you are likely to get at the end of the month. And then, of course, you pay that back.
Now, leaving aside the question of the uplift that happened to universal credit because of the pandemic, but just looking at the operation of universal credit during the pandemic, has it been regarded as having worked well or badly?
It's been regarded generally as having worked well. So the numbers on universal credit have virtually doubled. And one commentator said that this was universal credit's moment in the sun. And the government said that it was because of universal credit's automation that it was able to deal with so many claims in such a short time.
Let's come to the question of the uplift. Can you remind us what the uplift is, how much it was or is, and who gets it?
It is an addition to the standard allowance of universal credit and also the basic allowance of working tax credit, which was made during the pandemic, quite early on, April 2020 onwards, initially for a year, and then it was extended to 18 months. It was £20 a week, so it's £20 for, in addition, for a single person. It's £20 a week for a couple. It's £20 a week for a couple with 2 children, 3 children, whatever. So it's actually just a flat rate amount, but it was clearly introduced to help people during a difficult time. And it is currently due, unless the government changes its mind, currently due to finish end of September, beginning of October.
Fran Bennett. Next, I want to know about the uplift and its effects. Tom Waters has worked at the Treasury and the Office for Budget Responsibility and is now Senior Research Economist at the Institute for Fiscal Studies. Tom Waters, from your research, what's been the impact of the uplift on those receiving universal credit?
So the key thing here is that existing claimants' universal credit get a really wide variety of entitlement. And so what £20 a week means to you is going to vary a lot according to how much you're already getting. So if you're not getting very much universal credit, you know, maybe you're getting £75 a week or something, then it could be 20% or even a bit more than 20% of your weekly entitlement. But for other people, a fairly significant fraction of people, it's 8% or even less of their entitlement.
Now, just in broad terms, why is there such a big variation in what people get on universal credit?
So universal credit gives more money to couples than to singles, gives more money to people with more children and to renters. So if you're a single person, don't have any kids and you don't pay any rent, then typically if you're out of work, you'd get, with the uplift, you'd get £95 a week. On the other hand, if you've got a few children, you're a couple and you're renting, you can easily get £400 a week, sometimes even more than that. So you get really big differences according to these characteristics.
What proportion of people currently getting universal credit are currently in work or are usually at work? Because I suppose we ought to look both before and during the pandemic.
Yeah, so at the moment, it's about 40% of adults receiving universal credit are in work. Now, that's probably a bit lower than it will be in the long run because UC hasn't been fully rolled out yet. And also because of the pandemic itself has meant simply fewer people are working. So in the long run, we'd expect that figure to be a bit higher. But I think that's important. The fact that people often think of it as an out-of-work benefit, but actually almost as many people get it who are in work.
Is there any evidence that universal credit has encouraged more people to get into work or indeed to move on to better paid jobs?
So one way to think about this is with what we call financial incentives to be in work. So how much extra do you get moving from out of work to in work, say? Overall, universal credit doesn't make a huge amount of difference compared to the pre-existing system on this. For some people, it strengthens their incentives to be in work. Other people, it weakens their incentives.
Really?
What it does do is, under the old system, you could sometimes be in a case where if you earned an extra pound, you could lose 96p of it in higher taxes and lower benefits.
Was that what we used to call the poverty trap?
Yeah, exactly. And universal credit does get rid of that, though you can still lose as much as 80p, so still relatively weak incentives to increase your earnings.
Okay, so it's not clear that it either encourages people into work or out of work or to get better jobs. We're just really not at all sure about that.
The only direct evidence we have on this, which actually looks at people, some people who are on universal credit and then similar people who are on the pre-existing system, that does suggest that universal credit increased the number that are in work by a bit, but it's only for a very narrow group of people. So it's not clear that it's super informative about the universal credit population as a whole.
We should be able to measure the effect of the uplift actually pretty directly upon poverty figures. What could we say about that?
There could be an effect kind of in the order of a few 100,000 people in poverty because of that. It's important to remember that those poverty measures, it's literally just measuring, are you above or below a threshold? And so if someone's already in poverty and their income falls further, that actually doesn't increase poverty as is measured. And so
it increases misery.
Indeed. So the uplift might just about move them one side or the other of this threshold. But there's lots of other people who are going to be affected by it, who, you know, might have already been in poverty or just out of poverty, who aren't pushed one side or the other.
What could we therefore say about the removal of the uplift in terms of its overall impact?
The effect on reducing poverty coming in, if you like, is also going to be about the effect of increasing poverty going out. So again, that kind of number of a few hundred thousand.
What you're saying is the same few hundred thousand, roughly, who moved above the poverty line with the uplift will go back below the poverty line if the uplift is removed, broadly.
Yeah, so that's a sort of a good guide as to what will happen.
Overall, what kind of contribution does universal credit and the benefit system make towards the alleviation of poverty? In other words, if you wanted to really have an impact upon poverty in Britain, is a big uplift in universal credit one of the things you would look to do?
I definitely think using universal credit or other benefits which are targeted towards poorer families, that is one of the most direct ways and immediate ways of reducing poverty, because you're just putting money into people's pockets the next day or whatever. if the government really wanted to reduce poverty numbers, they certainly could do that by boosting universal credit in a number of ways. Wouldn't necessarily just have to be this £20 uplift. There's other things you can do. But in general, increasing the UC budget would have a big effect. All that said, as ever with making benefit policy, that comes with trade-offs. It costs more money, which has to be paid for in taxes, and it also tends to weaken people's work incentives when you increase benefit spending.
Tom Waters. Finally, given all that, if I were the Chancellor or the Secretary of State for Work and Pensions, what are my options? Joining me now are Gemma Tetlow, Chief Economist at the Institute for Government, and Devon Gilani, Director of the social policy business Policy in Practice. Gemma, I'm imagining that I'm the Chancellor of the Exchequer and you're advising me. Could you talk me through the economic pros and cons of ending the universal credit uplift now?
The arguments in favour of ending the uplift are firstly to save the government around £6 billion a year, which has been the extra cost of giving universal credit claimants £20 extra a week during the pandemic. The other reason to end it is that this was a change that was made in the real height of the crisis of the pandemic, when it looked like many people would be losing their jobs and the government hadn't yet come up with the furlough scheme. It was an emergency measure to get money out to people who really needed it. It wasn't the sort of change to universal credit generosity that you might make if you'd sat down with time to think about what was the thing you really wanted to do. Those are the reasons to get rid of it. The reasons it will be difficult to get rid of are that universal credit is received by the lowest income families in this country, and taking £20 a week away from people, which for some people could be as much as a third of their income that they're getting from universal credit, means that that really will be noticed by them.
Now, the balance of those arguments is economically do it, politically maybe don't do it. Devon, are there any economic arguments for maintaining the uplift?
Yeah, I think there are. You have 6 million people on universal credit now, doubling from the 3 million that were on it just before the pandemic. Today, 18 months on, you've still got 6 million people on universal credit. So really fundamentally, I think one economic question is what's changed for people. I think the other big economic point to make is the economy is still 5% below pre-pandemic levels. I think the government's argument is they want people to work rather than rely on welfare. There are two main issues with that. One is the economy isn't back up to the levels that you expect. And fundamentally, two-thirds of people on universal credit are either working full-time, or not expected to work at all. So I think there are some really strong economic arguments for keeping it as well.
Okay, so broadly, I'm looking at the usual cost-benefit analysis of this, which is, I might very much like to save spending some money given everything, but people are going to start shouting at me, so that's a problem. I'm going to transmogrify now into the Secretary of State for Work and Pensions. If the Chancellor tells me the uplift should end, and maybe I think it should end, should I argue to keep the £6 billion in my budget and target help on any other groups, Devon?
Well, firstly, if the Secretary of State did want to keep it and make that case to the Chancellor, I think the first point I'd make is the furlough scheme has cost £60 billion over 18 months. Well, this extra £20 is costing £6 billion a year. So you could make the case that you should take away one thing first, given a lot of those people on furlough are going to end up on universal credit anyway, and see how things pan out rather than making all of these changes all at once, which poses a much bigger risk to the economy and to the people impacted by it.
In other words, wait until you've got rid of furlough before you do this if you're going to do it.
Yeah, see the impact, see what happens to the numbers of people on universal credit depending upon it. If you did want to cut it and agreed with the Chancellor as the Secretary of State, I think there are a couple of options that would soften the blow. I think the first one is to keep it in place. So rather than create a big cash cut overnight for those families affected, you could keep it in place and let inflation erode it away. And that's been the government's preferred choice over the last decade. So you've had over £26 billion a year worth of savings that add up cumulatively from cuts and freezes to benefits since 2010, which really puts the £6 billion into context. You know, it's really only making up a small amount of those cuts over a number of years, and those are all going to be felt overnight. I think the second option for the Secretary of State would be to say, actually, universal credit is pretty flexible. You can target that cut to specific groups of households on universal credit. Now, the Secretary of State would need to make judgments about who deserved it and who didn't. But if you wanted, for example, families with children to keep it, you could take it away just from single people. That's about half of households on universal credit and would save around £3 billion. Another group you might want to make the case deserved it more might be those in work. So to do that, you can increase the work allowances, which is the amount you can earn before universal credit's withdrawn. You can increase those by £20 a week, which means those in work get to keep that extra money while you can take it away from those who aren't in work. Now, the government would have to explain why it was making those decisions to people. And in the context of really quite a muddled approach to making cuts to Social Security, it really hasn't stepped up and said how much it thinks people should receive and why. And that's the big gap there.
Gemma, would you fancy making those arguments if you were the Secretary of State for Work and Pensions?
Any other ways of spending the money apart from just a flat £20 a week would be more difficult to explain to people. But you could target the money towards some of the problems within the universal credit system that were already recognised before the pandemic. As Devon said, one area you could look at would be increasing work allowances or reducing the taper, so how much people lose as they move into work or increase their hours of work. Both those things would help to improve work incentives, particularly for second earners in households, which is something many people have been arguing for even before the pandemic. There are also some long-standing problems with the five-week wait that people have when they first apply for universal credit or move over from tax credits. You could use some of the money to give those people an upfront payment to ease some of those problems. That would help to target the money more effectively at some of the problems that were recognised to exist, but it would be a more complicated way of doing it.
Right. Now, we've heard that universal credit has come through the pandemic pretty well. In other words, people have said, actually, this system works quite well under stress. Are there any big things that I could say as the Secretary of State for Work and Pensions to the Chancellor about how that just kind of goes to show it's worth investing in, Dan?
Yeah, absolutely. I got involved interested in Social Security after claiming benefits myself. And if you imagine 3 million people having to go to three different agencies administering a whole range of benefits, each of which have their own rules, that was the system we had before. That would not have held up at all during the pandemic, caused huge amounts of time, energy, frustration and administrative cost. But fundamentally, people just wouldn't have gotten their money on time. Universal credit has shown that it is a more effective system on which to build.
OK, I'm back to being the Chancellor of the Exchequer now. And broadly, I am looking at two big impulses, quasi-political impulses, which are motivating me and the people around me. And the one is, I'm a Conservative. And as a Conservative Chancellor, I ought to be keen on reducing the number of people claiming universal credit. Now, let's suppose that's the route I want to go down. How can I do that without actually cutting the benefit in the first instance, Gemma?
The main way to get people off universal credit is to boost their incomes through either getting them into work, increasing their hours of work, or boosting their earnings once they're in work. So some obvious policies that the government could think about would be increasing access to low-cost childcare. That's one of the things that stands in the way of parents of young children getting into work or increasing their hours of work and boosting their incomes by doing that. The other factor, thinking about how you increase people's hourly pay, you could increase the national minimum wage to do that. However, the government has already increased the minimum wage quite a lot. And if we compare the UK to other countries around the world, our minimum wage is quite high relative to average earnings now. But you could instead think about, for example, boosting skills and training policies to give people better skills and therefore hopefully make it possible for them to earn higher wages.
People always say skills at this point. I imagine that chancellors always say that's great, but that's always a fairly long way off. Would you agree that these are roughly the measures that I should think about taking as chancellor in order to try and wean people away from universal credit?
There's one other big driver of the benefits bill, and that is the cost of living. So if you think about 40% of universal credit is spent on housing costs, that is money that doesn't really go, it goes through the claimant, but direct effectively to landlords. If the government were able to reduce costs, those savings it would make, it would improve living standards for everyone. The savings it would make through, for example, the housing benefit budget could go toward retaining things like the £20 uplift. And the main problem the government's got there is all of the indicators are going in the wrong direction. So you've got rent returning to pre-pandemic levels. You've got rising inflation at 1.8%, but I think rising faster than that for lower income households. You're seeing energy and water bills go up. So it's much more of a medium term challenge, because otherwise the benefits bill is going to continue to rise through no fault of claimants themselves.
I'm still Rishi Sunak, Gemma, and let me play out a scenario for you. My young special advisor has just said to me, I have a radical post-pandemic thought, Chancellor. You've bitten the bullet on social care. Why not do it on poverty alleviation and really boost universal credit for most claimants and thereby take a lot of people out of poverty? How should I respond?
The major concern with increasing out-of-work benefits, although UC obviously does go to those in work as well, is always that it discourages people from working and engaging in the labour market. I think one thing that the pandemic has highlighted with the introduction of the furlough scheme was the fact that the UK, unlike many other European countries, doesn't have any form of social safety net that provides anything like earnings replacement when people first lose their jobs. We were faced with a big macroeconomic shock, lots of people losing their jobs. There weren't other jobs for people to go to. But our unemployment safety net is really a very low level, very heavily means tested income. That compares to other countries where you would get partial earnings replacement, and provided you had contributed to the system, you would be entitled to that earnings replacement benefit for at least a short period of time after you first lose your job. I think a much more radical reform, therefore, and learning lessons from the pandemic, would be to ask whether the UK should consider something more like this social security safety net, that at least for a short period of time you would be entitled to a benefit that was related to your previous earnings, that rather than thinking about increasing the generosity of out-of-work benefits for everyone, for those who've been out of work for a long time as well as those who've been out of work for a short time, should the UK adopt something like other countries have with a short-term earnings-related unemployment benefit?
Devon.
The introduction of the furlough scheme absolutely highlights the fact for me that the government recognises it's a parallel social security system that effectively gave much more money to people that weren't able to work. And I think that for me highlights a recognition that social security is insufficient for most people if they had to live on it for a long period of time. So I think Gemma makes the point that an earnings replacement approach might be okay for a short period of time. The question is what happens to those that haven't been able to get back into work. And fundamentally, I think one thing the pandemic highlighted with the number of people moving on to universal credit is that actually misfortune is quite random. But actually people have been stuck on social security for a long time, and perhaps those that haven't been able to work, essentially that's misfortune. It's not laziness or lack of attitude. As I mentioned, you know, 2/3 of people on universal credit are either working or not expected to work. So it really comes down to value judgments from the Chancellor around, and we've seen this, who is deserving and who isn't deserving. But I would say social security has effectively been cut to the bone and then cut some more. So that in itself gives reason, I think, just to at least keep the £20 uplift in place. One final point, if I may, is this government hasn't really, it's been happy to freeze and cut social security for a period of time and say it's too much. It hasn't really been put in a position where it's had to explain to the public to say, actually, this is how much we think is sufficient. And that's a really important question for any government that's trying to really grapple with and tackle social security.
Gemma, what do you think the government is going to end up doing? I know it's an unfair question, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
History suggests that Chancellor's governments find it very hard to cut the cash incomes of the lowest income households. George Osborne, when he tried to cut tax credits in 2015, quickly reversed on that and instead went with the approach of essentially cutting benefits for future claimants, but not for existing claimants. I think it's more likely, therefore, that the government may go with something like the approach of freezing the £20 a week amount and just allowing it to gradually wither in real terms over time, so that benefits will get back to where they would have been without the £20 uplift, but do it gradually over time rather than take the money away.
Gemma Tetlow there with Devon Gilani. And my conclusion, this is a tricky one, and I am glad I'm not the one making the decisions. My thanks to Gemma Tetlow, Devon Gilani, Fran Bennett and Tom Waters. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Simon Coates, Kirsty Knight and Jim Booth. The sound engineer was Neil Churchill and the editor is Jasper Corbett. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you might like other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. Last week, we explored how the world will manage the flow of Afghan refugees. We've also looked at the threat from ransomware and asked if HS2 is still on track.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Paris. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.